You were talking fish wheels.
Oh, right.
Rick, hello, this is Olaf. I'm on the call.
So, Ben, how many think you're going to be on?
Have joined the conference.
I'm thinking we're pretty close, actually, from what I got here.
You got 10 now.
It should be about it. Let's see. Just trying to write down everybody that I've heard. So we have Tammy and Bjorn, I think I heard, and Dave Wills, and Tucker, and Scott, and Rick, and Olaf. Who have I missed?
Trevor.
Trevor, thank you.
Tom Lawrence.
Oh, Tom. Good morning. I think that should do it, actually. I know we were scheduled to meet face-to-face after FPOM next week, and we certainly still can if there's need or desire to. I just wasn't sure if everybody could make this, and, you know, if there'd be something new enough next week to discuss to warrant that, but I guess we could just wait and see what happens. I was just asked to try and get something going as soon as possible, so I thought this might be the easiest way. I kind of just wanted to go over context, what we have, what we're bumping up against now in recent years, and sort of objectives of what we'd like to do, or like to see changed, I guess, with what we're doing out here, mostly with trying to reduce handling and, of course, you know, some of the draft tube stuff, which isn't handling per se, so much as just incidental impact with unit startup and that sort of thing. So I'll just kind of tell you what has changed here, really since I've been here. But don't blame me, I didn't do this. It's just kind of a strange thing since I've been here in 04 when we started doing ladder dewaterings. Especially ladder dewaterings, there were literally zero sturgeon that we'd find. Not until 07 did we have anything of significance number-wise, and it started with about 160-something fish in the B-branch ladder of Bradford Island. And then it's kind of become an exponential increase since then when we have to do the lower portions of the ladder, which is not every year, but it's you know, it could be every year, depending on need and, you know, the status of maintenance required for the low water stuff. So, you know, as you've heard, this past year we ended up in the Washington Shore Ladder, ultimately removing about 2,700 fish, 1,000 in the south end and 1,700 in the middle and north, which is just crazy. It's a huge burden to remove them. Just from a maintenance time, you know, cost standpoint, not even getting into the impact that we potentially run for having something bad happen to a lot of fish. These are big fish, as I'm sure most of you have seen on the video, a good portion of them. And we're just to the point now where it's starting to have such an impact that we can't do much about it besides spend, you know, a week in this case, removing them by hand. It's just what we want to avoid, if it's possible, and we're not sure how best to do that. So that's kind of how this whole thing came about. I just asked if folks who have concern or who have interest participate and try to brainstorm some different approaches to what we've historically done, because it's getting hard. It's impacted us to some extent where we can't even take ladders below tailwater when numbers are, you know, it gets to be difficult enough if we can't flush them out where we've just called it quits, basically, and so we're not going to take this ladder below tailwater because the risk is too great, and the equipment that we need to repair is not significant enough. But you know, that's getting into a gray area where we're having to make a call that we'd rather not make. We'd love to be able to take it down and do the work we need to do and bring it back as we have in years past. So, you know, as it's impacting cost and the work window that we have and everything else, that's sort of what's, you know, initiated this discussion. I don't think that's probably big news for anybody at this point, but you know, and really, I know folks are going to have various opinions about it, but the thing that we want people to consider is just any approach that will not put us in this situation, whether it's taking ladders down a different time of year, whether it's not taking them down at all and just doing some of this maintenance with divers, but that gets to be super time-consuming, you know, far less effective, obviously, than working in the dry. The cost is, you know, astronomical, really, compared to working in the dry. So that's kind of the context we have for that. I mean, the draft tube stuff is another issue. We have, you know, fish that go in there when units come down. And we've addressed that as best we can, which is just doing slow rolls every time a unit comes back, which minimizes the impact, doesn't eliminate it, but does definitely improve the conditions in there for fish to get them a chance to get out of there before there's, you know, a full speed startup. And that's a little bit different, but it's, I think it could still be something this group addressed, because, you know, one is basically the ladder where we have to have a selective approach because we can't just eliminate all fish inputs into there, obviously. Draft tube, on the other hand, could be something more drastic because there's no reason for fish to be in there, so we could, you know, whether it's physical or electrical or whatever kind of barrier, that's in a way an easier solution, I think, although, you know, we haven't addressed that either. So that's kind of what I wanted folks to think about. I guess, does that make sense to the group?
It does. Do we know where, when they enter the ladder and where they go?
No. And I think that's the first thing we want to know, with whether it's, you know, tag fish or it's in cameras or whatever. It would certainly be the... I kind of feel like we're operating in the dark on some pretty general information. I mean, what we know, Scott, from, like, ROVs, you know, we do the ROV twice a year. We'll do it August time frame in January, usually. They're not there in August, and they are there in January. And other than that, we've been sort of assuming that the aggregations we've seen in the tail race, you know, along the corner collector and the spillway, you know, we've gotten a little bit better at knowing when they're gathering in those kind of winter aggregations, for lack of a better term. But it's pretty broad. Our knowledge is pretty limited.
This is Olaf. I could add to that in general that those the results that you see from the ROV work is fairly consistent with the reports done by Jack Pajkov back in 51 and DeVore and Grimes in 93. And in both studies, there was evidence of a general pattern of upstream migration in the fall, and then a sequescent winter period with downstream migration in the spring, with large congregations of the sturgeon in the estuaries in the summer. So those were the two, you know, broader migration and behavioral pattern reports that I was able to put my hands on. But, you know, details about in and around the dam structure, you know, how that behavior in that particular area below Bonneville, I don't think we have details on that.
Okay. That's
but we don't pass the ladder, do we? You're talking about from the estuary back up to the dam? That's
correct,
the
yeah.
That's about the best info we have. And you know, we've sort of, we started off doing the protection with slow rolls based on what we were seeing in the winter, and then gradually extended that window in the fish passage plan as far as the verbiage in there, kind of as we went. So it's, you know, I realize it's the best we could have done, I suppose, but it would be nice to have something a little more scientific to base our protocol on, because right now I really feel like it's, you know, we kind of improve it based on every impact that we stumble onto, so it would be nicer to be a little more proactive about it instead of reacting to, you know, fish injury or mortality.
Have we ever looked at narrower sleds?
Nope. We have not. I know there was a fair amount of discussion on the bar spacing when they went in. And I don't really even remember how that was settled upon, Scott. I want to say it's just under 16 inches.
Right, right. The reason I bring it up is there a chance that we could make a narrower sled for part of the fall? So for a ladder we know we're taking out in October, you put in the narrower sled, try to keep out the biggest of the sturgeon, and I mean minimize the handling of the whoppers.
I think we'd be happy to do it.
I mean, because if you get into smaller sizes, they're a bit easier to move in quantity.
Absolutely.
And you seem to have the ones that are like the 5-6 footers on lots of those, but not a lot of little ones.
Sure.
Yeah. So is there a way we can keep the big guys from going in there?
I mean, the big ones for us are by far the hardest. You know, we can drop in fully, you know, more, I would call them just more nicer tanks.
Sure.
You know, that have O2 and everything in them and really make it a smoother process if we were able to handle only mid-sized to smaller fish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're stuck using those that big tank that you've seen before.
Yeah.
When we get into those oversized fish, and then we just don't have a tank, and I don't even know of one. I've tried to look for stuff that's off the shelf. So unless we custom build something, we can't really improve our handling of the oversized fish.
Would there be any value in having a second big tank?
Yeah, I think there would. And I think we probably will have that this year. I just requested a couple months ago for us to be able to have one constructed, so we would hopefully have it for this winter maintenance period.
And are there any
we do Bradford Island.
Any improvements to design they could make?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. We've been talking about it with the rigging crew because there's some advantage to changing the way you pick that thing so you can actually dump it without having to set it down and reconfigure the way it's attached to the crane.
Mm-hmm.
Just everything to make it more fast, really.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think you can. We were going to slope one end a little bit better. If there was a way to figure out to put a gate in there, or some sort of way we could drop them a little smoother, obviously that would be preferred. So we're trying to figure out, you know, what's going to be best. It can't be overly tall. Obviously, we have to be able to reach into it. So there's some limitations just based on what you have to be able to do to get fish into it, obviously, because you're talking about some pretty heavy fish. Folks can't lift that over their head, obviously, but yeah, that's kind of what we're trying to balance, is what can you still get in there, get filled with water, you know, hold a significant amount of fish and still keep it, you know, friendly for them as far as being, you know, rounded. And really, we want something that can get them out of the tank easier and back into the tail race.
Is there a design issue or problem to make those larger tanks such that you could dump the fish from the bottom of the tank, as opposed to, you know, what I saw in the videos looks like kind of a tilting operation, which means you have to probably keep it up off the water a little farther to manipulate the tank?
Yeah, I mean, I think there probably is. We definitely want something. The tricky part of it is having something that's going to hold water and yet, you know, function that we can trigger a gate or a door or whatever to open. It would be ideal if you could just lower the thing level and have the bottom drop out of it right at the water level.
Can you drop that thing in the water and go all the way in the water and then come up?
Not currently. I think that would be ideal if you could. I mean, just go down and set the thing in the water and have the bottom open up.
Well, not even the bottom open up. Just literally take the whole tank, put it in the water like it is, and then bring it back up and make the tip occur when you're coming back up.
The risk that we have, and folks, of course, didn't understand that from seeing that video, which is a drawback, is dipping that tank into the tailrace right below the units.
With the current. You know, just pull the crane in.
Yeah, it's putting they don't like putting the dynamic load onto a crane, and they will avoid it at all costs. I think that's, you know, we weren't dropping them from above the water for fun at all. Yeah, obviously if we could, we would set it right in the water and just tip the thing there, but there's a risk safety-wise to setting that thing in the water in that current.
How many units would you have to have off to get you an eddy that you could put them into?
Yeah, two maybe.
Because turn those two units off.
I think that's what we'll have to do in the future because, you know, that's a concern that everybody has, of course. And I think it could be twofold. I think we can come up with a better tank. You know, that tank existed when I came here. I don't even know. I'm assuming that it was constructed here.
Yeah, they just got a boiler.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what they had on site.
That's based on need, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
But like I said, in the first 3 years I was here, I never even saw the thing or knew that it existed until we bumped into that issue in 07. So, yeah, I mean, I think that will be improved, that the new tank will be better, certainly. And then we can do some operation changes to help.
The other thing that I know, it looks bad to drop fish, but I mean, I can do a cannonball from pretty high. I don't think we're harming fish by dropping them the 10 or 15 feet at the most.
No, and really, I mean, folks, it was a little bit deceptive, I think, from the video, but I would guess, you know, just based on being out there and then, you know, even looking back at the video again, I don't think they were more than probably 3 feet. It's a little deceptive having the camera up on the deck.
Yeah, I mean, they dropped some higher.
Oh, yeah, absolutely been dropped some higher. And I'm not too concerned about it. Really, in that case, that's up to me as more of an appearance issue for people that don't know what's going on with the operation. But you know, I mean, obviously we'd like it to be as, you know, less stressful as possible.
Yep. Well, absolutely.
And I think we can with a little bit better tank and with operation changes. I mean, it's certainly evolving, this whole process. We've gotten a little bit better at it. We're getting faster at it. But to me, it really seems I feel very reactive to it. So we're, in part because it changes every time and it gets bigger and more involved every time. So, I mean, you're kind of always behind the eight ball, it feels like, because we're not, we can't foresee what's going to happen. And then, you know, we're sort of making changes on the fly, which I think that's based on lack of information and just lack of, I don't know, lack of other alternatives probably.
Well, speaking of lack of information, this is Dave Wills. I guess that leads to the concern I have. Scott brought it up. Could we get some better information on when they start entering?
I think it's vital.
Yeah.
It should be the first step in my
When do you do your first ROV?
We do ROV in August, and we do one in January.
Okay.
We won't have another one until, you know, and that could change.
Well,
I mean, we can, you know, based on time to do it, we can go out there and drop it in this month.
Well, that might be worthwhile to get a series. I know it's not cheap, but to get a series, time series, to kind of track what happens. I guess what I'm wondering, and maybe others are too, is are the sturgeon more or less seeking shelter from sea lions in the spring? And then in, you know, by August, everybody's gone.
Right. I don't know. I mean, I think...
Well, I know we don't know. That's one of the questions.
When do the stellars show up again? Or do some stay around all year now?
They almost stay around all year. They're showing up in January.
Yeah, that's the kicker, because their patterns have changed now.
Right, they're the main sturgeon predators.
Right.
Sure. And you can see it, I mean, if you overlay when we've seen these sturgeon numbers with Stancil's sea lion arrival dates and numbers, it correlates roughly. His numbers have become bigger and earlier every year, so they ramp up like that the same way our numbers ramp up.
Hey, Ben?
Yes?
This is Bjorn. We were even talking this year with the sea lion stuff about actually starting our observations earlier. January to the end of May, and we're starting to talk about doing, starting in maybe even late October, having observations occur November and December, because we're seeing a lot of sturgeon takes during those months of fall. So those late fall is kind of they're starting to hit them pretty hard already.
Right, the chum monitoring crews see them in November and December. You can go out and see some pretty spectacular events of them taking them.
Yeah, I guess I don't think we will know. I mean, we kind of guess that's the case because it's the known variable change. But I really don't know. I mean, we've seen the fish congregating, and now we've seen the fish congregating in the ladder. So, I don't know if they've taken a normal wintertime behavior and just sort of adjusted it based on predator presence or what, but I don't know. I guess it would certainly be nice to have a better seasonal understanding of the movement, and then we could adjust whether it's with physical barriers or operations or whatever else more appropriately.
And I think that would be useful regarding lamprey and whether or not the 50% conversion from that junction pool is due to sturgeon or just mechanical, physical attributes.
Mm-hmm.
You swim between them all? Here's some candy. Come on through.
Buffet line.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it is interesting. We thought that before when we started to see some poor lamprey numbers, and we start to see these big numbers in Bradford Island because, over there they're less dispersed because they're congregated in the diffusion pools, which are every few weirs.
Okay.
So, literally when you get in there, they are wall-to-wall sturgeon, so it's like you can't even imagine a lamprey swimming through there hardly.
Yeah.
So I don't doubt that that's they wouldn't have to make much effort for one of those fish to suck up lamprey as they swim by. But I realize this group's not going to be able to solve this quickly because we don't even have enough information probably to solve it at the current time. But I just sort of wanted opinion and brainstorming, and then the support of the group to kind of get us in a direction which I think should be like you guys have mentioned. Information gathering initially, because we just don't know enough to be smart about it.
Yeah. Well, and the super short sounds like build a second tank.
Yeah, and the second tank is kind of a done deal, but it's something I've already requested and I've got the okay to do funding wise and everything else. So now it's just a matter of getting we want for dimensions and features.
Do you also need more bodies?
Based on what we did in January and in December of this year, more bodies, you mean to actually be down there handling fish?
Sure, because I know it takes additional training to get the fall protection.
It does, and it wasn't really a limitation for us this year. I mean, we had enough folks. At some point, you kind of get in each other's way. This was one of the bigger locations for us. Actually, it's going to be the biggest location that we're going to dewater and have this issue, besides maybe the Powerhouse 1 collection channel, which I don't even know when and if that'll happen, but I think we did okay.
The reason I bring it up is if some of us want to have the time to volunteer to help you, but we need to do the training ahead of time.
Absolutely.
If the project is willing to have others come on, and we just need to plan to have the training.
Yeah, and what we have is, we had our crew of biologists, so we had three from my office. We had Bjorn there from Fishfield Unit, and then we had a couple guys from up at the Dalles. So we had a fair amount of biologists, and then we had some maintenance staff on hand here just to be, extra hands.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we did fine with
regard to numbers. You know, we knew based on going into there after the December salvage that we're going to have some significant numbers, so we sort of geared up for it accordingly. You know, it's I think we're okay in that regard, but yeah, again, if people and we decided we wanted to have outside folks come in for whatever reason, we would certainly, they'd have to have some training to be able to be in a man basket and such.
Mm-hmm. So if you can factor that in to give the folks that might want to do it some time to get the training.
Okay.
Well, that certainly addresses the symptom of the problem. And obviously, as Ben has said, the ideal would be to prevent the problem in the first place. So thinking back now to information, is there something we can do beginning now that is fundable and doable to start getting that information?
So, Ben, how long does an ROV survey take a day per ladder?
Yeah, it just depends on, if we wanted to do the entire project, it would be a two-day event. I mean, we own an ROV now, so we have a little more flexibility than in years past. We're not contracting it out. But it's, you know, it's got some limitations. You get into some areas where the biggest limitation is probably field of view. It's just really hard to get numbers. You can do looks like a lot versus, you know, not. But not very good. I mean, you're not going to be able to get in there and say, here's our peak numbers versus...
No statistical accuracy.
None. None. I mean, you literally are flying along in that thing and bumping into fish. And, you know, they're pretty patient with the presence of that thing. So it's not like they're super skittish like salmonids are, but they, you know, they're swimming away from it as you're coming up to them. So it's just hard to know. I mean, they can certainly tell the difference between August and January. I just don't know if you're going to be able to see that the increase, say if we did it every month or something like that, if you're going to see a difference between October, November, December kind of thing.
Yeah, because trying to figure out when the peak is or how long the mass of them are there would be very helpful.
Yeah, it would be great, actually. And I think maybe in that case, again, I don't really know the best scenario besides maybe outfit our entrances with Didsons or something like that.
This is Dr. Jones. My ignorance of the setup, I know that there are pit tag arrays within the fish ladders higher up, right?
Have you left the conference?
Excuse me, hello?
Hello.
This is Tucker. Did anybody hear what I just said, or was I...
I heard you, Tucker. Didn't
yeah.
So, pit tag antenna arrays are higher in the ladder?
Yes.
So, I mean, I just am thinking off the top of my head, a way to know and have a better handle on that is if you had pit tag antenna arrays lower in the ladder. We have 2,500 fish tagged so far. We're tagging more every year with pit tags. So, certainly you'd start to see a portion of those fish probably heading into the ladder via pit tag antenna arrays if they were lower down. And I don't know if that's possible or not, but it's an idea I have.
So. No, I mean, I think it's possible. The other alternative is there are half duplex arrays down low that they use for lamprey. That might be an easier approach if we could get half duplex tags for sturgeon as opposed to, you know, trying to go back and put in new pit tag detectors at the entrance.
I think that's pretty unlikely, at least from where we're at.
Yeah.
Half duplex tags in there, you know, a lot bigger tag and less wieldy. So.
But it is, yeah. I mean, that's the kind of information, obviously, that we want is a little bit something a little more statistically robust and. Well, I mean, anything's going to be more statistically robust than what we currently have, but that's the kind of stuff we're trying to get our head around what we're even dealing with before we start jumping at solutions.
Doesn't the Army have some sort of magic camera, like an infrared camera or something that they could throw down there?
Maybe. I mean, I think the Ditson probably has, you know, of course it's got some limitations with... if you have enough turbulence, but
right.
you know, in the right location, I think that could be useful. It would take, obviously, some reviewing of film, but I'm not sure the best approach to it. It just seems difficult and slow to get results if we're going to wait for some sort of tagging.
Right.
But, you know, I don't think anyone's going to oppose us going that route. I think we just have to decide probably what's our most effective means of gathering some of that information. I don't think any of them are probably going to be so costly that we can't do it. And obviously, from the Corps' perspective, this thing is already a costly proposition. So whatever we can do. And you know, I realize folks don't know the details of the whole operation, but when we have to do this, my concern and the reason for bringing it up was we've done really well with it up to now, especially considering we didn't really know what we were getting into. But, you know, depending on where you are, some of the dewatering of those structures is not as controllable as we would like. So there's always a level of concern that, you know, something's going to drain faster, something's going to drain fully that we don't want. And I could certainly explain that to folks better at a different time in detail if they wanted. But my concern is always that we're going to dry fish up. And we're talking that many. It's not like you can just run in there and pick them up real quick. So
that would be a PR nightmare.
It would, indeed. And that's, maybe it'll never happen. But my concern is it doesn't take much to go wrong before you're in that scenario that would be bad for everyone.
Yeah.
Especially
the fish.
2,000 fish, indeed.
Hey, Ben, this is Trevor.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you guys took any measurements on those fish that you pulled out of the ladder to see, like, average girth on those, because when you're talking about putting some different size sleds in there and that sort of thing, it may be helpful to have some width measurements or some girth measurements to see if that's even a feasible alternative there.
We did not do any of that, Trevor. I mean, and the thing is, not that it's not possible. I mean, we could certainly do a sub-sample and do that. It's really, when we're doing it, that's why the whole, even though it's kind of a researcher dream for access to sturgeon, the idea of having someone there trying to tag fish or do that kind of thing with them is so time-consuming.
Mm-hmm.
When you're dealing with them, because as you can see from the video, once you get the water low enough to actually start handling them, the water gets murky, it gets to be a water quality issue and everything else. You really are just trying to go as quickly as you can to get them out. So like stopping to do any of the things that would be nice just hasn't been done. Not that it couldn't be, but it would almost require like a separate crew that could take a subsample and deal with it as we're continuing to work fish out.
So this is Rick. Where was this video available? I have not seen it yet.
Rick, you might be the only one that hasn't seen this. I believe it's available on YouTube still.
Yeah, if you go to YouTube.
I can send you the link, Rick.
Okay.
Type in Sturgeon Move into the search box of YouTube as the first video that comes up.
Sturgeon what?
Move, M-O-V-E.
Okay.
Starts off with still photos, then goes to video after a few minutes.
So does anyone have any questions on kind of the situation we have? I mean, I know we have lots of questions on the process and that sort of thing, but does everyone understand what we're up against and what we want to kind of have as objectives to change?
I think so.
Okay. I think at this point, you know, I know it's tempting to just start throwing out solutions. I don't know how useful some of our ideas will be without the information. I certainly don't want this to be a excruciating process, and you know, I want to avoid foot dragging and everything, but I do kind of feel, and I'd like for folks to say if they agree or disagree, that we have to have more info before we start jumping at solutions.
I think that's absolutely appropriate.
Okay.
But again, we can't make this an excruciatingly long, slow process either.
No, then that's what I want to avoid for sure. I mean, I've seen how some of these
right.
processes can go, obviously, and you know, we're gonna have it again this winter. So, not that we're out of this one yet, but you know, ladder's watered back up, so we're out of it for the short term. But you know, when we do Bradford Island this coming year, I can fully expect the same scenario.
Well, this Tom Lawrence, the one thing I totally concur that more data is always good, but I don't think we're probably going to have any data before we have to do water again, so we're going to have to try to think of some common sense or best judgment practice we can to minimize your guys just having to handle that excursion, things we try to do to minimize that.
Yeah, and I don't even know what that is, Tom. I mean, I hope that we have a new tank built for the actual handling, but I don't know how we minimize it.
Yeah, I was going to suggest, the only thing we can think about trying to do is we might try dewatering earlier and hope that this upstream migrate, we catch it before they start this upstream migration.
Yep.
Try to water the ladder sooner. That's about the only thing I can think of we can do right now until we have some more information or some ideas on the slide. Because there's no way, even if we can get the whole region to coalesce around the idea of putting, I guess you can still call them sleds since they'd be sturgeon including devices.
That's right.
It's a good acronym, thank God. There's no way you guys be able to build anything by four fall, and I know Frederick has consternation about putting sleds in anyways.
Sure.
So, and if we're trying to go a narrower bar size, that could be interesting.
Yeah, I don't even know what it would require, truthfully. I mean, like Trevor said, you know, we get those big fish in there eating shad when we have the sleds in, so it, obviously what we have in there isn't enough. And
Rick,
I know there was concern over bar size, even when we did the initial sleds, so I don't know what folks would be comfortable with as far as a reduction in bar spacing, but I think it's going to be substantial because I think those fish, if they want in there badly enough, whether it's for food or shelter or whatever they're seeking, they can turn sideways. They can do some, I think they could fit in smaller spaces than we might expect.
Yeah, and then the problem is then you're basically excluding salmon, which is
right.
A lot of work, so that might be kind of a way we can't go. So, I mean, I would just take a look at your schedule and see about for next year until we get some more information or some ideas of what we could do to keep sturgeon out or a better way to get them out of the water without having to handle them all. I mean, that's the only question we have is, Bradford, do you guys feel you have a way to do a better flushing job? I know B2 you don't, but at Bradford, do you feel you have a better way to maybe potentially flush and move some of those sturgeon out?
We do, yeah. I mean, A branch and B branch of Bradford have just a different arrangement, which allows us to, you know, like I said, they settle in the pools, and then they're, you know, they're pretty much not in the majority of the weir pools. Well, they're not even pools really, but the diffuser portions are sunken, so they hold water, and that's where the sturgeon end up. And we're able to open basically diffusers and flush those fish out just by pushing them with water. It works pretty well. The one problem we had that I alluded to earlier was we went to do that last year, and the fish valve that supplied the conduit that we used to feed the ladder broke. So just bad luck, really. But what that did was it stranded all these fish in these pools. I mean, in water, don't get me wrong. But it was going to be just a huge task, you know, of the magnitude we were talking this year, probably not the total numbers, but, you know, just stacked in there like cordwood, ridiculous amount of fish, and we made the call not to do it because, you know, the maintenance just didn't justify the effort and the risk. So, you know, we do have a better means, assuming everything functions properly. But short of that, all we can do is, is have a better salvage plan, which to me is obviously a last resort, but I don't know if we're going to fix anything between now and December. But, you know, as far as doing it early, if we got permission to do it, we'd jump at that, you know, in a heartbeat.
Well, I think that's something we should probably want to talk about next Thursday then.
Sure.
I mean, definitely B2 would probably be the spot you'd want to definitely do early. You guys think you maybe... So is that fish valve fixed for B2?
It is, yep.
So
now, granted, those things are notorious for breaking, but, you know, these are the main fish valves that basically feed all the diffusers. So when one of those breaks, you're truly out of luck.
And you work at Bonneville, and things tend to break there.
So. They do, and you know, over there, I mean, it's no small task. It's replacing a pretty large component. That, you know, I mean, it's kind of the design is. I'm not even sure what it would take to retrofit something more modern and maybe more reliable. But you know, I guess. You know, considering the lifespan, they have been relatively reliable, but they're just they run the risk of not functioning. So we'll use it when we can, but I, you know, wouldn't be what I'd want to rely on, obviously, going forward.
Yeah, I mean, just thinking off the top of my head, what I kind of had thought is maybe the idea we use like a Ditson, an ROV or something earlier in the season, see how many sturgeon are there. If we don't see many sturgeon and that kind of stuff, then you could maybe say, hey, we can delay, do what can go but to a normal dewater. If you start seeing sturgeon, though, maybe that's a trigger, maybe come up with some sort of trigger mechanism saying, hey, we're seeing this many number of sturgeon, looks like we should start the dewater now or sooner.
Mm-hmm.
Rick Kruger
has joined the conference.
Rick, you just can't decide if you want to be on or off, can't you?
Yeah, right.
I mean, so the thought was maybe we use the ROV as a kind of a trigger mechanism for determining if we start seeing sturgeon, then we maybe say, let's do the dewatering sooner. Because I don't think any of us really want you guys to have to go down there and try to remove that many sturgeon and that stuff. And maybe at B2 we're going to be lucky this year. But maybe we try to come up with a trigger mechanism for that. And then as you guys get, we get more information, we start to try to come up with better means to either keep them out or just try to make it more efficient to flush them out or... two tanks to figure out how to get rid of the sturgeon.
Sure.
Suggestion we had that we talked about internally is if you guys start seeing sturgeon that you think are not doing well, we might put a column that you guys like, maybe those would be the ones you want to put in the floor bed. If you see ones that are not really feeling well or moving and that kind of stuff, maybe those are the ones you want to put in more of a sanctuary location and not put it right back in the tail race.
Yeah, I mean... You can see that a little bit, I suppose. I don't know if folks understand what's required to do it. In general, as I think everybody knows, we put sturgeon back in the tail race. We put fish back where they came from, unless they're migrating. We put them where they're headed. So we've done that kind of. That's what we've done since I've been here, and I think it makes pretty good sense. That's been brought up a lot, like, how come you didn't put them back in the forebay? But people need to understand that to do that, as it is, whether it's one tank or we have two tanks, it's still going to require putting a tank on a flatbed, driving that flatbed around the project up to the forebay, hooking it back to a different crane you have to have position on the forebay, and putting it back. So it's, I mean, if folks thought this process was slow, it's going to be a lot more handling time and time in a tank, to put them in the forebay. So we people to consider that it's not like a, you know what I mean, it's not necessarily a magic bullet to be able to put them up there. You do increase some other risk in doing that.
No,
I was going to ask if that would be approximately the same sort of trucking and stuff to move them to, let's say, a barge. Thinking in terms that if we are having a period of time where we have a large number of these fish being caught, putting them into the juvenile transportation barges and moving them down away from the immediate area of sea lion concentration might be a solution. Of course, the cost of that is big, but maybe it's justified if, you know, you're caught in a situation where there's lots of sea lions and lots of caught sturgeon. So is that about the same deal there? You'd have to truck it to a location to put them into a barge.
Yeah, I mean, I would think that that would get to be prohibitive unless you were able to have a barge sitting up against the powerhouse where you could literally crane them directly into a barge. I think you're going to get into a, you know, it would require a completely different tank. At that point, I would want a tank that obviously was enclosed that they couldn't get themselves out of, that we could put oxygen to, and that we could make much more, that could sustain them, you know, in a healthy condition for a significant period of time.
And also those barges, the way they're set up to load, they're set up to load juveniles, not large fish. It was when they were putting kelp into the barges, it was like one at a time, run them down and trying to put them in a transfer pipe. There's really no easy way to throw them onto a deck. You'd have to set up some sort of transfer pipe system.
Okay.
If you want to do that, that'd be something we can look at, but that's not going to be something quicker. These barges were at like transport facilities, which are set up to load barges, and I don't think, well, I know we don't have any.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I guess people just need to factor, it's kind of hard to know what the best approach is, but, you know, this process took us 4 days, and people have concerns over, obviously, rightfully so, handling of the fish, how long they're in a tank, how many fish are in the tank, you know, how they're released, all things that we're, you know, we want to make better. But if it's going to, you know, I think some of the improvements are we're going to run into other problems. You know, you're going to put them in a better location, but all of a sudden you've just, you know, tripled their handling time and their time in a less than ideal environment. So it's kind of tough to balance some of those things, and I certainly don't have the answer to it, but I just want people to, and I'm not trying to, you know, poke holes in anybody's idea. I just want to try and point out some of the challenges we've had and why we've done some things and not others. But, you know, we don't claim at all to have the best solution to it. So this is the kind of thing I want people to just not, there's not a bad idea out there. If people think of something, please throw it out, because, you know, I just want to be able to point out kind of the on-the-ground feasibility component and really nothing more.
Yeah, no, Ben, all I would think is if you do have two tanks and you start seeing fish that are in poor condition, those are the ones you might have as candidates that you'd want to release somewhere else, whether you want to drive all the way down to Hamilton boat ramp, which I don't know how you're just going to be doing those, or have, hopefully we'll have some other crane availability at Bonneville, or we just know that we need another crane available when we're doing.
I think you're right, Tom. I think we'll have to just assume that when we go to do it, we'll have to have multiple things set up with contingencies on, you know, if we have a ridiculous amount of sea lions, or if, you know, we got a bunch of fish that don't look good. I think the best we could do is just do, you know, try to incorporate kind of all the reasonable ideas that folks have had with having multiple cranes, multiple release locations, anything we could think of, you know, just to make it faster. I think, given the circumstances, this was about as fast as we could do it, and it was still 4 days. You know, I think people are concerned about the time they spend in the ladder. That the water you see in the video or photos in there is not the water they spent, you know, 4 days in, just so folks know that's the case. But, you know, nonetheless, they're trapped in that channel for longer than we want them to be, regardless of water quality. So anything that's going to drag it out to be twice as long, it isn't going to be very appealing, I don't think, for the fish or for most folks.
Hey, Ben,
this is Olaf.
I'm just, are we at maximum hazing levels right there during that period? I'm just wondering, you seem to mention there was somewhat of a correlation with stellar sea lion increases and the number of sturgeon that you're finding in those fish ladders. And I'm wondering if we might see a reduction if they increase hazing, or if that's even an effective means, it could possibly reduce the numbers in there as well.
Yeah, we're not hazing at that time at all, actually. Is that Trevor?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, the hazing program hasn't started yet at that point. I think, you know, we got, when we felt like there were more sturgeon there, more sea lions there than in previous days, which, according to Robert, that's just kind of a, I think the sea lion numbers actually doubled in our tail races in general, by chance during that period. So that's what I think we were probably seeing. They weren't, you know, upward dumping fish, but they were in our tail races, and that's when we asked for a hazer to come over there and spend time on the 55 deck where the operation was taking place. And he spent a day there, but the Stellars are a little bit skittish when it comes to the activities going on here. So with the crane activity and whatnot, they're not getting right up next to us. He was of limited use from the deck. He fired 3 shots all day. So I think if maybe we had guys on the water, as unpleasant as that might be in December, January, because since they've started hazing here now, they do respond better than California sea lions to hazing, and that, you know, if we can keep them a little further downstream, all the better. So I think that's another thing that should be implemented when it comes time, is put a boat on the water in the you know, vicinity where we're doing the stuff and keep them at bay, and I think they probably could have an effect at that point.
Yeah, I'm thinking not only while you're doing the operation, but also, say, you know, a month prior, a couple weeks prior, maybe potentially keeping the sturgeon out of there. They don't feel the need to go in there if there's not so many sea lions running around in the tail race right there.
See, that's the part that's hard for me to correlate, because we have, you know, when we know that there's fish in there, you know, like I said, we pulled 1,000 out of the south end of Powerhouse 2 in December. But as far as I know, and I'd have to ask Bjorn or Robert for sure, we didn't have large numbers of sturgeon. I mean, I can't get that straight. Large numbers of sea lions in our tail race at that point. So that's the part that's kind of hard. They're here, but they're not, like, you know, I wouldn't think they were in numbers that would drive fish into there, if I were to guess. It's almost like, and this is, you know, I have talked about that with my fellow biologist here, that it's, you know, it almost requires some cognitive effort on the part of sturgeon to know at that point that they should be seeking refuge in the ladder. And that part is a little bit harder for me to accept, but I don't know how worthwhile it would be just based on the sheer low numbers of sea lions at that time of year. I mean, I like I said, I'd have to ask Bjorn for sure, but if you're talking like November, you know, if we're taking ladders down in December and you get guys here in November, I don't even know how many animals they'd be able to haze.
Yeah, I'm just seeing from a correlation perspective on those the numbers of fish you've seen in the ladders compared to the silver sea lion increase. It seems like there's a correlation, but that may be due to some other factor that's just occurring with time as well. So.
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't really know. I mean, it looks like that on paper, but then again, I don't know, because I don't have the information based on when those fish are actually getting in that ladder. Well, does anyone have any questions or further comments on any of this stuff for now?
Well, this is Olaf. I had just a little piece of information to throw out there, asking what, you know, girth measurements were on sturgeon and the like. Just looking at some range of sizes of probably what you had there for green sturgeon, their girth is about 67% of their fork length, and it's pretty linear through most of the size range for that fish, and that species tends to be a little more skinnier. So I'd say that'd be like just a quick minimum girth ratio to fork length, but we probably have some data on white sturgeon somewhere over the years that we could look at if you need that information from our various tagging operations.
Okay. No, that's interesting. Actually, it would give us some idea of, you know, what kind of bar lengths, at least for discussion points, and then see how comfortable people are with that kind of reduction in spacing.
Yes, this is Tom Lawrence. One last thing. So, since we're not going to have a lot of fresh data before we have to get into some sort of dewatering next year, what I would probably suggest is, one, take a look at the dewatering, your schedule. Let's think about doing some alterations on that potentially. Maybe look at an ROV trigger, and then also take a look at diving. Say, like, what's the cost difference going to be? Do you have to dive it versus not? And throw that in front of FPOM and say, hey, which path do you guys think we want to go down?
Sure.
I mean, there might be some times where we could do some of the stuff, like it's not a big cost difference between diving and the regular work, but there's probably going to be times when it's going to be pretty much to the point of cost prohibitive unless you guys suddenly get a big O&M Christmas present bonus, which I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right, Tom. I think it's the cost is going to be ridiculous depending on the job, and there's going to be some things that just flat out aren't doable with by divers. They're going to lack access and knowledge, and they're probably not going to put their guys in certain situations. But I can get, I'll try anyway. I can talk to the dive safety guys and see, you know, throw some kind of general concepts out there for duration and scope of work and see what they can give us for a ballpark of cost. And I think that makes perfect sense because we can do, you know, once we get closer to that time of year, we can start doing some late summer ROVs and maybe do it on a monthly basis or see what we have time to do even more frequently. It would be nice. I don't know how realistic that is, but yeah, if we can get in there and just get some baseline information for when we start to see them and go from there. And I'd be happy to do it as a trigger and maybe just have FPOM's opinion or support to do it, you know, potentially do something a little bit earlier if we see a window of low numbers. Well, I think unless folks have something more, maybe we'll just go forward from here by bringing this up to FPOM with what we've thought about to get the groups, the full groups opinion, and then I can certainly, from our end here, we can move forward with doing the ROV kind of stuff to start gathering information. And other than that, I guess maybe we can get some feedback from maybe the group as a whole for what other means would be the primary way for us to gather some of the movement information, cameras or otherwise. And then, you know, like Tom said, we're not going to get answers from that soon enough to affect this winter, but we'll take the steps we can with tanks and cranes and seasonal change or protocol to accommodate for this next winter, and then hopefully go into the following subsequent ones with more info in hand.
And I guess one last thing I was going to say, are we going to start thinking about, I don't know if we do it right now, but start thinking about like maybe some change forms to incorporate and just people have an idea of what we're doing on this sometime down the road?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Maybe FBOM can kind of guide what they'd like to see or be willing to offer up with regard to flexibility with, like, you know, like Scott had mentioned with, you know, when it comes time to do that, if we can have the flexibility. In this case, it would have been taking units probably 17 and 18 out just for, you know, that week, you know, moving them so we have the ability to dump fish a little more successfully there and that kind of thing. So, yeah, I think change forms would be ideal just to give us the flexibility to. And that could be driven by, you know, I can supply the information on what our limitations are and folks can give whatever they feel is a comfortable and reasonable accommodation, I guess.
Ben, this is Dave.
Yes.
If you end up being limited on time or money or manpower or whatever to do ROVs, would the lower section of the Washington ladder be the priority?
Yes. You know, I think what we would do probably, Dave, is we can do, even if we're doing like a spot check, you know, what takes a long time is we go through and do the ROV and it takes 2 days, but what we're doing is looking at all the diffuser grading, you know, all the shafts of the diffusers that are
okay.
Coming down. So, you know, if we're just getting in there and doing like a relative presence, absence number, you know, estimate, that can be pretty quick.
Oh, okay.
So I think we can do that probably pretty reasonably. And yeah, and we can certainly prioritize based on where we know they've been in the past and probably where we have the next dewater.
Yeah, okay. Well, I guess I don't know what the plan is for the Washington ladder. Are you going to dewater it next year?
We will not dewater it next year, no. We'll do Bradford Island next year.
Okay.
So
it sounded like you're saying then that the Bradford would be especially important to know what you're going to be seeing if you're going to dewater that, but I certainly, and I think you would agree, that getting the information on the Washington ladder is still critical this year, too.
Oh, for sure. And I think, I don't think that's going to be too hard for us to do.
Okay.
You know, we only do the lower part of the ladder, so we could get in there and drop something at both ends of Washington Shore and the same at Bradford in the entrances where we've seen them historically and just, well, historically as in the last 3 years. But, you know, where we know we've had problems in the past, and I don't think that's unreasonable for us to be able to do pretty regular from here. Probably.
Well, I guess I'd like to ask you and others there to kind of think what regular would be, if it would be once every 2 months or once a month or every day, you know.
Sure.
Come to FBOM and let us know what you're capable of doing on a regular basis.
Okay. Yeah, and not that you guys need to be in the weeds of it all, but we're limited right now just because this thing is a relatively expensive piece of equipment. There's only two people here that are qualified to fly it. But we will, this summer, have four more pilots trained down in California. So we'll have more flexibility here coming up into the fall.
Okay. Well, I guess I'd certainly like to at least have a starting point sometime this spring, if we can do one then.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't mind doing it as soon as we can. We're in the middle of our NavLock overhaul right now, but I don't think that it's unreasonable to think we could even do one toward the end of this month, and maybe just off the top of my head, I'm thinking once a month is probably reasonable, at least to start and see if that's going to get us the information we need. Maybe we can dial that in a little bit better as we go, but I think we could accommodate that anyway.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, that's about all I had for today. I just kind of wanted folks to know what we were sort of looking to do and get some feedback. So I think I'll go down this road and bring up a couple things at FBOM and go from there, unless folks have anything else. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ben.
Yeah, thank you all for calling. Ben
has left the conference.
David.